Today we light this chalice to remember that each one of us is unique and wonderful. And the words that we light our chalice to come from Dr. Seuss. Today, you are you. That is truer than true. There is no one alive who is youer than you.
For who shall we live? And how will we be remembered? Inheritors of the moment, our legacy never ends. This life's for the living, for the loving and the giving. It's a gift for the children of the generations ahead. My heart is full and my hands are open, and the work of love is the life I've chosen. My arms are wide in the world that's broken. We're the holy tribe, this human race in motion. For whom shall we live? And how will we be remembered? Inheritors of the moment, our legacy never ends. This life's for the living, for the loving and the giving. It's a gift for the children of the generations ahead. My heart is full and my hands are open, and the work of love is the life I've chosen. My arms are wide in a world that's broken, with a holy tribe, this human race in motion, this human race in motion.
Some people tell jokes. Some people tell stories. Me, I'm a quotes guy. I often search out and recite the words of others to invoke inspiration, drum up motivation, help center my thoughts, or fill me with courage. Today we will hear many voices of inspiration. My hope is that somewhere in these words you will find the peace, enthusiasm, or bravery that you need for the upcoming weeks and months ahead. Let us worship together.
Paying attention. Two of the things I have read in the past have stayed with me deeply and for years. Both are about paying attention to people. The first is from Jane Howard's 1973 memoir called A Different Woman. I no longer own the book, but I could almost reconstruct this entire passage from memory. With the help of the KSU Library, thank you, I tracked it down so I can share the real version of this with you. Jane Howard wrote, "Friendship was my mother's vocation. She kept confidences. She did not gossip. Instead, she was always doing people, who in turn did her, preferably when her feet were under their table or theirs under hers." Let me explain. Do, in this context, is a transitive verb. It takes an object. It can, in fact, overwhelm its object. Do thus means to take under one's wing, to shelter, succor, nurture, concentrate on, listen to, cause to feel central. It's not easy to do people in absentia, even if they're at SI, which was what my cousin Mary Louise was implying when she said to my mother over the phone, "Oh, Eleanor, I just wish you could come over to Oak Park and put your feet under my table." The practice of doing continues. "Hey, go do Dr. Covington. She's standing all alone over there," Anne or I might whisper to each other at a party. We all do and are in turn done by our friends, who are all from time to time our caseloads, just as we are theirs. Everyone, according to an as yet unpublished monograph, on the caseload theory of interpersonal relationships, is entitled now and then to be a caseload. We become caseloads when we are worse. This is in capital letters. Worse is one of three possible human conditions applicable alike to men and nations. The others, as you might expect, are better and the same. This method of explaining things may lack refinement, but it offers a convenient shorthand. How's Julian? I might ask Peggy. He's the same, she might reply. We're not going to have to do him just yet. But Liz is better. Liz, Julian's wife, annoyingly enough, is always better. I just love that. It stuck with me for two reasons. One, it's a relief to know that I can sometimes be the one who's worse, the one who needs to be done, at least so long as I don't abuse the role by demanding it too much. But mostly, I learned a simple blueprint for acting a bit less self-centered, that I could take someone else under my wing to shelter, succor, nurture, concentrate on, cause to feel central, as well as to be taken under someone else's wing sometimes without condescension or judgment on either side. The second thing that stuck with me was from a professional journal, an article called The Economy of Attention. Back in 1991, the idea of people's attention as a commodity was strange and new. Today, you know, social media ads consciously rely on the belief that our attention should be monetized. So many clicks, so many eyes on the device for so many seconds, and that means money. But back then, paying attention usually meant paying attention to people. John Rouse wrote, "Like wealth, attention is a commodity always in short supply. No one ever has enough. We want so much to draw some attention our way, to gain some recognition, validation from others, or else we feel ourselves fading away to invisibility. Our sense of self depends on it. There are few things more gratifying than the warm glow of self-satisfaction that comes from receiving one's proper recognition. Yet we're required so many times to pay attention rather than to receive it. A payment we make only with a secret hope that our turn to collect will come soon, and then the light will be ours. But of course, others give us their attention reluctantly. They need so much for themselves." Now, I think of that especially as I'm standing up here and you're paying attention. I've spent most of my life as a teacher, and I'm kind of used to the sage on the stage mode. But one thing I learned, partly from Rouse's article, was that the guide on the side is really the better teacher. The idea became a tool in my teaching. I learned to listen with my eyes, my expressions, my body language, and learned that the teacher up front model isn't the only way or the best way to teach. And I began teaching kids how to give positive attention to each other and to use that as a mode of teaching. It was a tool, but it worked. Then I got my first job teaching at a university. I came from Kent, went to the St. Louis area. I was one of two new hires in the department. I was from 500 miles away. The other hire was a local person whose degrees all came from the university where we worked. This is almost never happening. It never happens. But they knew her, they loved her, they respected her, and she was really, really good. I couldn't help seeing us in competition, and sheesh, was I intimidated. Leela seemed more active and intense when she listened than when she talked. When she watched someone talk, she had a habit of turning her whole face toward them, and it was almost as if the sun came out. A non-judgmental, accepting, caring, warm sun. And she made little encouraging nods a lot. I wondered about adding that tool to my repertoire of looking like I was paying attention. But gradually, I realized that her gaze, her nods, her expression were not tools in an arsenal, They were her genuine desire, a need to understand what people were saying and what they really meant. It made her feel good. It gratified her to understand. She wasn't trying to look caring. She actually cared. She was truly interested and encouraging without judgment. It wasn't a tool. It wasn't faking it. It mattered to her. I've been lucky enough to know people who are amazingly good at doing others, at sheltering, concentrating on, listening to, causing to feel central. Think for a moment, who comes to mind? Can you think of somebody that you know, several people if you're lucky, who are really good at that? Friends, relatives, maybe colleagues, they really pay attention. What a gift to know somebody like that. And very likely, some of the ones you know are members of this community, because we do practice the fragile art of hospitality. We have a model. It's one of our UU principles to reflect, to respect the worth and dignity of every person. And we practice that as a community. Very likely, you know somebody in this community who models for us paying attention and knowing whether we're better, worse, or the same. And that's so important. If you're fairly new to this community, don't think that this is only the old guard who are like that. We do need to get to know you, and let us get to know you. And you need to get to know us. We get to know each other lots of ways in this church. Right now, a good chunk of us are in Oberlin or on their way to Oberlin at Summer Institute. That's a wonderful place to get to know people. But we eat together, we drink together, we even learn how to brew beer together. We play board games together, we camp together, we do all kinds of stuff. And we work for social justice causes and lots of things. And that's how we get to know who each other really is. I know that the key is paying real attention. And that's the heart of this congregation to me. Even though Melissa's moving on, the heart is going to stay here. And I hope that we can all practice paying attention a lot as we move through this transition. We remember all the places of pain in the world today, those currently in the news like Turkey and Nice, those that have faded from the news, and the many we don't even hear about, and the personal pain of those we know, ourselves, our friends. Our hearts are heavy. What can we do? We cannot be paralyzed. We can pay attention. We can care. We can take thoughtful action when we can. And we can rely on each other. Because when we're together, we multiply by many, many times our power. We ask for strength for everyone dealing with pain. We ask for increase of joy for those who are knowing moments of happiness and peace. And we ask for kindness from all of us to all of us. May it be so, and amen.
Okay, so I love getting the chance to quote Neil deGrasse Tyson. I think he always comes up with the most whimsical and perspective-creating words whenever he's asked out of the blue a question. And I wasn't going to share this one with you today, but I'm going to share actually two readings because I think they apply to this service. So he did a theater kind of town hall meeting, where he asked, the audience asked him questions. And he got asked by a six-year-old boy the question, what is the meaning of life? Smart kid. And he did correct Neil deGrasse Tyson. He said he was 6 3/4. So this was his response to the little boy's question. So what is the meaning of life? I think people ask that question on the assumption that meaning is something that you can look and go, here it is, I found it. Here's the meaning I've been looking for. That scenario, however, does not consider the possibility that meaning is something that you create. You manufacture it for yourself and for others. So when I think of the meaning of life, I ask, did I learn something today that I didn't know yesterday, bringing me a little closer to knowing all that can be known about the universe? If I live a day and I don't know a little more than I did the day before, I think I wasted a day. So the people who at the end of the summer school, say, ah, the summer, I don't have to think anymore. I just don't know. To think brings you closer to nature. To learn how things work gives you a power to influence events. It gives you power to help people who may need it and to help you yourself and your trajectory. So when I think of the meaning of life, that's not an eternal and unanswerable question. To me, that's within arm's reach of me every day. So to you, at age 6 3/4, may I suggest that you explore nature as much as you can. And occasionally that means getting your clothes dirty because you might want to jump into puddles and your parents don't want you to do that. You tell them that I gave you permission. So the second part of this reading was a question that he was asked when he did a Reddit AMA, which is an Ask Me Anything. Basically, it's an internet forum where celebrities go on and people ask questions and that person responds to those questions. So the question was, what advice can you give a young man looking for inspiration? And here was his response. The problem, not often discovered until late in life, is that when you look for things like love, meaning, motivation, it implies that they're behind a tree or under a rock. The most successful people in life recognize that they create their own love. They manufacture their own meaning, and they generate their own motivation. For me, I'm driven by two main philosophies. Know more today about the world than I knew yesterday, and lessen the suffering of others. You'd be surprised how far that gets you. Okay, everybody take a deep breath because I'm about to flip this service upside down. Gets pumped up? Right. Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place. And I don't care how tough you are. It will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. It's how much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth. But you gotta be willing to take hits. And not point fingers saying you ain't where you wanna be because him, her, or nobody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that. Rocky Balboa. So I wanted to open my reflection, which has probably turned into a sermon, with that quote because it gave me the chance to wear this super cool headband and whatever the heck these things are called. No, but seriously, that quote is a great reminder that life is tough. It's supposed to be tough. But every single person in this building is a winner because you are here. You've been hit before. You've been beaten before. But you're still here. You are better than all of life's hits. So let's back up a moment. As I said before, I'm a quotes guy. So I keep a collection of quotes on my computer that I've gathered throughout the years. Every now and again, I'll see a quote that qualifies, and I'll add it to the list. I'm pretty picky. These words come from all walks. They come from dignitaries, sports heroes, writers, people in my life, and so on. Oftentimes, I'll refer to that list when I'm looking for perspective. This reflection is a journey through some of my most meaningful recordings in that journal and their application to my life. So I discovered that I was a quotes guy after my first big speaking engagement. That was many years ago. While writing my speech, I thought I'd be all cutesy and tell some jokes, right? Because why not? Everybody loves jokes. Well, unfortunately for me, it was 7:45 in the morning, and my audience was a mob of 400 engineers. Now, engineers, if you don't know as a whole, they're not really known for their humor. In addition to that, I learned that day that I have a terrible, terrible sense of comedic timing. And therefore, I bombed. I vowed to never tell a joke again in my entire life. I even considered that to be my last public speaking engagement. But shortly after that mini nightmare, I was expressing my complete and utter embarrassment to a colleague of mine. And you know what he told me? He said, "There's only one person in your life who remembers your screw-ups. Do you know who that is? You." These words touched me deeply that it helped me to move on. It's true. The people watching me bomb over this introduction, they have other issues and matters going on in their life. I really doubt that they're going to remember the day that Justin bombed. It also helped me realize that I learned that jokes don't work for me. I took it as a learning experience instead of a failure. Samuel Smiles said, We learn wisdom from failure much more than from success. We often discover what will do by finding out what won't do. And he who probably never made a mistake never made a discovery. So as a message to everyone out there, go out and screw up a bit. It's okay. You will fail, but you might also learn something. And for those of you who are afraid of failure, I ask you, can you tie your shoes? How many times do you think you failed before you finally succeeded in tying your shoes? You've failed before, you will most likely fail again, and that's perfectly okay, because ever try, ever fail, matters not. Try again, fail better. I reference this quote from Samuel Beckett often. I do a lot of home improvement, and I involve myself in projects in which include skills that I may not yet have acquired. In my early years of doing this type of work, I would get so absolutely mind-blowingly frustrated at my results. I did the research into how to do the skill, so why am I not succeeding? Well, age and experience has taught me a hard lesson. Practice and repetition breed results. They say that it takes 10,000 hours of practice to master a certain skill. Now, if you never slept, if you never ate, and all you did was practice that skill, it would still take you over a year to master that skill. So you will fail a lot, and it's natural, but each time you do fail, fail better by learning. Until you finally succeed. H. Stanley Judd said, "The important thing to remember is that it's okay to fail and to keep trying. Don't be afraid to fail. Don't waste energy trying to cover up a failure. Learn from your failures and go on to the next challenge. It's okay to fail. If you're not failing, you're not growing." Okay, so let me tell you a story about my laundry room and my bench. So one day I decided to remodel our laundry room. And there's a ton of stories here, but I'll spare you most of them. So I had a plan. I would have this laundry room demoed and completed before the birth of our second child. This decision came in August. William was due in February. I mean, we're talking like 6 months here, plenty of time. I had a plan. Well, Some people like to say, tell God your plan and watch him laugh. I think that phrase was outdone by the famous boxer Mike Tyson when he said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. To me, this quote's hilarious, absolutely hilarious. Because as November, December, and January rolled by, I felt like I was getting punched in the mouth repeatedly every minute. Everything went wrong. The biggest issue that I had was I had to rip up the tile floor that I had contracted. I had a contractor come in and put in the floor. It was horrible. So I had to rent a jackhammer hammer out. This delayed me for weeks. And everything was built from the floor up. So I needed this to be done. And bless my poor wife, she had to deal without laundry facilities for over a month because I had a plan. Luckily, I was able to get a capable tile contractor to come in, finish the floor, and I spent day and night completing the cabinetry and plumbing to bring the washing facilities up and running before William was born. So I think that we forget sometimes that life has plans of its own. There's even a guy named Murphy, who you may have heard of before, who seemingly dedicated his life philosophy to anything that can go wrong and will go wrong. Okay, so now onto the bench. Whenever I do projects, I turn into this perfectionist monster. I'm not like that in most aspects of my life, but generally, if I'm going to spend my time doing a project, then I want it to be right, and I want above average results. Unfortunately for me, I've learned that my expectations for above average results are like way in the stratosphere for most other people. But I've accepted the monster that I am because someone once told me, you're the one that has to live with it. You can either live with it and move on or make it right. My brain was wired to obsess over my screw-up, so I tend to go the extra mile to make sure I can live with it. Okay, so this bench. Our laundry room connects to our garage, and so I built this bench in the laundry room for the application and removal of shoes. The bench was the rock that this laundry room was built on. It had to be perfect. Do you know I painted that darn bench 7 times? Yeah, 7 times. Every time I painted it, it just wouldn't look right, and I had to paint it again. But to be fair, and so most of you don't think I'm a complete lunatic, during like the 4th coat or something, I switched the primer and the paint, and I primed it again, so then I obviously had to paint it again, so then we ended up with 7. Anyway, in the end, I have this beautiful bench. It's gorgeous. It is perfect. I am so happy. It meets my standards, and I got the bench done the day before we left the hospital when William was going to be induced. So we had the baby. Everything is wonderful. We had scheduled people to come over and take care of our animals while we were away, and a bunch of people came over and brought us food. Super nice. Cool. Everybody entered through the garage. After the baby was born, I came home to get some sleep and bring Isabel home, and I entered through the garage, and I saw a dent in my bench. Someone lovingly had brought us a mason jar full of chili and dropped it on the bench. It didn't break, but obviously the lid had impacted the bench because you could see the little nubs from the lid in the bench. At first, I was really upset. But then I just stood there and I laughed. The whole insanity of painting this bench 7 times to come home and have a dent in it, the irony was just way too much. I think I blew a fuse. But at that moment, I remembered a quote that I'd written down a long time ago by Sunru Suzuki. He said, "We should find perfect existence through imperfect existence." That quote helped me embrace the fact that there is beauty in the imperfect, and quite frankly, sometimes the effort is good enough. Hopefully this whole experience is a lesson that we can all take away. Your plans aren't going to turn out the way you want, and you need to learn to roll with the punches of life in an imperfect existence. Speaking of an imperfect existence, I think we're all kind of sad about Melissa leaving, to say it lightly. I'm sure most people had visions of her leading the congregation into the sunset and having that storybook ending. But what I think we need to realize is this isn't about us personally. Therefore, we should be nothing but happy and excited for the new opportunity. Not only is it an opportunity, but it's also a challenge for us. How we react and respond defines our true character. So instead of focusing on the negative of the coming future, let's rejoice and celebrate everything we've created over the past decade plus. Savor the memories, the joys, and everything that we've experienced. There's never been a more appropriate time to reiterate the words of Dr. Seuss. Don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. Finally, I will leave you with my own personal mantra: get better every day. It's totally cliche, and it's been said a million times in a million ways, but every day is a chance for improvement. And this doesn't have to be life-changing or earth-shattering improvement. Any tiny thing you do better today than you did yesterday is an accomplishment. For me, maybe it's getting up a minute earlier, starting that one thing I've been putting off, not eating the whole carton of ice cream, or just taking the time to send a message to somebody that I was thinking of. I often share this mantra with others. For example, when somebody makes a mistake, instead of reminding them of the mistake, just simply say, get better every day. Well, if it's really bad, well, then you got a different conversation. But when I get frustrated myself, I have to remember, just get better every day. Emerson summed up this feeling for me when he said, finish each day and be done with it. You have done what you could. Some blunders and absurdities have crept in. Forget them as soon as you can. Tomorrow is a new day, and you shall begin it serenely and with too high a spirit to be encumbered by your old nonsense. Tomorrow is a new day. May you go forward with the courage to make a change, accept life's plan as it comes, take delight in past memories, or fail just a little bit better next time. And remember that even if you do achieve perfection, somebody will probably drop a mason jar of chili on it anyway. We leave you today with these words from Albert Schweitzer. At times our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. Go in peace.